It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to our guest. And, you know, we talk about a lot of things on this show, and I think we're going to hit just about all of them today. There's a new book out called Comfortably Unaware, and it hits on so many of the things we talk about on this show. It's All About Food. The author is Dr. Richard Openlander, and Comfortably Unaware, Global Depletion and Food Responsibility, What You Should Choose to Eat is Killing Our Planet. And Dr. Openlander is the author of Comfortably Unaware, and he is a sustainability and wellness advocate, writer, and speaker committed to improving the health of our planet through literary work or in person. He brings an eclectic combination of experiences regarding this topic spanning the past 40 years. Since the early 1970s, Dr. Openlander has extensively studied the effect of our food choices that they have on our health and the immense impact those choices have on our environment. He is president and founder of an organic vegan food production and education business and has given hundreds of lectures, presentations, and open discussions on the topic of food choice. He has been a keynote speaker for the North American Vegetarian Society's Summerfest as well as other events and has presented lectures and workshops on numerous universities and colleges. He has been a featured guest appearing on radio shows and newspapers and magazines with his book Comfortably Unaware, as well as his speaking engagements. Dr. Openlander addresses the fact that our current choices of foods are causing global depletion, the loss of our land, water, air, atmosphere, food supply, biodiversity, energy resources, and our own health. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Openlander.
Well, hi.
Hi. I think we have a lot in common.
We do. We definitely do. And what a wonderful introduction. So good morning to you.
Thank you. It's always good to know that there are others out there pounding the same drum. Because it can be pretty lonely, and you've been doing it for 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. So it is. It is encouraging to meet people like you. And I do want to take just a moment to commend you. This is a great opportunity for your amazing journey and all the efforts that you put forth on behalf of a healthier and more peaceful planet. It's very well done. And you're right. Many times you feel alone in the experience. But it's wonderful to see people like you out there doing this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Fortunately or unfortunately, at this point in my life, I can't seem to do anything else.
I think that's fortunate.
Well, yeah, no, it's not that I don't have choices. It's just,
right.
It's so powerful. And, you know, I've read your book, and it's so easy to get frustrated, angry, upset. It's just incredible what's going on, and some things are so obvious, so clear. The answers are so obvious, and we know, those of us who have been living this life know that it's not hard. And when we make that shift, when we lift that veil, life is better.
Well, it is, and I think you hit it right on the nose. The difficulty really isn't in you know what path we're taking ourselves now. The difficulty is how to open the door for other people. And
that's it.
And you know, a great part of my book was about that, whether it was in isolated situations or in summary towards the end. But it's essentially trying to bring forth some realistic view for readers in terms of a better understanding of why they even have, you know, not only why they need to know all this and why they need to work towards this path, but what hurdles there are there for them and why they're there. I have one chapter called Tread Lightly, just about this issue, why we're hearing so many different things about our food choices that are just not right. And those are the things, unfortunately, that everybody's hearing. So you're right. That's what makes the road more difficult.
Well, I want to touch on some of the things in the book. Not everything, of course, because people should read it. But I want to go back a little bit. So you've been on this path in one way or another for 40 years. What was your beginning? Were you raised this way? Did you come at it from information?
No, not at all. It's a very good question. The way that I best can describe it is that it began pretty much by myself alone in a laboratory when I was conducting research in a medical science setting, mm-hmm. in medical school when I was there in graduate school. And so at that time it was primarily from a health and wellness standpoint because I saw what effect nutrients had at a cellular level, and therefore, you know, it just got extrapolated out into, you know, what it would be to our bodies. And to answer that a little bit better, I wasn't born into, you know, a family that, mm-hmm. you know, that educated me this way. So I was really a victim of our cultural influences, just like everybody else is too. So, and that's one of the things I try to emphasize in many of my lectures or workshops is that, you know, if I can do this, I mean, certainly everybody can. So later on, I became more of awareness, and as I researched through, in terms of just like many other people, I'm sure yourself, I mm-hmm. start putting together the environmental aspects beyond the health and wellness, and then there's always the other issue of the animals themselves. And so I really just wanted to kind of put all this together in terms of my writing and lectures, and so I have been doing that over the last 30 to 35 years as well, until it sort of ended up in this book.
Well, you know, we talk about three major subjects: health, environment, and the treatment of animals, and they're all very important and very compelling. Did you come to this for one more than the others in the beginning?
Well, as I said, I mean, at that first point in time, it was more from it was actually more from a health and mm-hmm. wellness standpoint for ourselves. But shortly thereafter, I'm pretty much a scientist through and through with that, and I really started uncovering many other aspects within a year or two or three. So now I think I'd have to add something to that, though, Karen. I think I would probably add that it isn't just those three, you know, sort of the triad of issues. I think it's an issue as well, a fourth, which is however you want to categorize this, but it's in the misinformation or how about education, how we're hearing about this, I think is equally as important as those other three.
Absolutely.
And whether you want to call it, in my terms, I'm starting to call it more sustainability because that's the word everybody's almost misusing these days. But it has to be, it's almost a fourth component of that picture now.
There's a lot of words that come to mind: short-sighted, political, personal, monetary gain,
mm-hmm.
that are related to all of that, because the reasons to choose the diet that we're talking about, a healthy, whole, plant-based diet, there are no reasons not to do it. And it's not a diet of deprivation. It's not a diet of dissatisfaction. It's a diet that makes you feel good. The food's delicious, at least certainly now, as compared to 10, 20, 30 years ago. I mean,
correct.
We've really come light years ahead with the cuisine. And there's no reason not to. And yet people find ways to color the truth and misinform for mm-hmm. personal gain.
Right. I mean, hence the title. It's, you're right, 100%. There's no reason not to, but unless you're unaware. And the other component is that if you're comfortably unaware, if you have all these other issues, whether it's cultural, social, political, economic, it just shows you how strong, you know, all these components really are. You know, I think the largest set of veils that I have ever seen is really when I'm visiting or interviewing. I mean, I've just interviewed and visited so many different grass-fed operations and actually conventional dairy farms and now aquaculture and fish mm-hmm. farms. And one of the most incredible witnessing that I've had personally of seeing all these bales thrown over someone or curtains that are just so thick you can hardly peel them off are on dairy farmers. And,
right.
You know, they're some of the nicest people in the world on one hand. And then on the other, they just, you know, you just can't get through all these veils. And that's, you know, that's an amazing thing, isn't it, to, you know, to see really all of these different influences affecting them all at the same time to where they just, it's almost improbable, if not impossible, for them to see exactly what they're doing right in their own backyard.
Yeah, and how do you get through all of those things? It's really incredible. I personally came to this a long time ago as a teenager because it dawned on me that killing animals was involved in what was being served on my plate, and that didn't work for me. I just didn't want to kill, and it wasn't something that came from my brain. It was something that came from deep within. I couldn't have debated it or explained it. It just mm-hmm. said, no, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think about the people that raise animals, even dairy animals, I don't know how they can do the things that they do. Because in
right.
dairy farming today, death is involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly my point. I mean, your reasons, or that principal reason for your decisions with your journey somewhat transcends even logic. It's more of a feeling that you have. And,
mm-hmm.
and these people, and that's exactly what I meant by that statement I made earlier, is that, you know, these farmers have so thick of a set of influences that they can't see what they're doing. And that to me is the epitome of how strong our influences have been, where, you know, there's so many other people that I feel that are unaware that are going to become aware, and that's why I wrote the book. But I think there are certain groups of people that are just going to take that much longer. And so, you know, so I propose other solutions. I mean, one mm-hmm. solution, wouldn't it be easy if just everyone could listen to your show and listen to you and what you're doing,
absolutely.
And read my book, and then you know the world would be a happier, more peaceful place, wouldn't it? But you know, I there's another set of solutions for all those people that we're just talking about that, you know, that have, you know, such a large set of armor, you know, thick set of armor on them, and those are going to have to be solved. Those individuals and that type of issue is going to have to be solved with things that I call eco and health taxes, and you know, there are other solutions that we just need to kind of move forward on for all those that would take longer than you or
right.
me.
I definitely want to talk about that concept because I like it, but I wanted just to finish up on this. So many people, you've probably heard it all over and over again, and I laughed a few times in the book because I was thinking, yeah, been there, heard that. I've heard people say, you care so much about animals, you don't care about humans. And, you know, this veil is very, very thick. This armor is very, very thick. And there are, you know, just horrific things that we do to people.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, you know, we have wars and things. And, you know, I'm just hearing about what we do to some of our migrant farmers to
mm-hmm.
get some of our plant foods.
Mm-hmm. True.
And it's just horrific.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's I mean, we all know the famous, you know, statement by Gandhi about the integrity and the value of a country can be gauged by how they treat their animals. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's really true. If and so you're right. It's a very large topic in the sense that, and that's why I always try to include the word peaceful when we're talking about generating awareness for a healthier planet. I mean, they both go hand in hand. If it's a truly healthy individual or community or planet, it'll be a peaceful one.
Amen. So the title is an interesting one, and I'm kind of going back and forth with it because I think some people are aware,
mm-hmm.
and I think they're uncomfortably aware.
mm-hmm.
if I can reverse the negative here, there are a lot of people that know and just aren't doing anything about it.
I agree. There are two different ways to look at, or more, to view what you just said. One of them is that I feel that I agree with what you're saying, but I chose what I would think would be the most optimistic title, and so that's why I went that route. And the second way to view it is that, regardless of the exact title, when you're talking about categorizing individuals on a global basis, I believe that they may be partially aware. I still believe that those people that you just mentioned, I agree with the inherent aspect of what you just said on its surface value, but I think that I really believe that there's something, whether it's the animals, whether it's the, you know, health for themselves, whether it's health for world hunger, where it's something they'll have to recognize they have a sliver there in their arm or their hand, and they're going to have to remove that sliver. And I believe that once they become aware that the sliver is there and what it's affecting, then I truly believe that they will be fully aware and then make the change. That's what I believe.
Yeah, I think for the most part people are unaware, especially outside of this country, and it blows me away. But, you know, unfortunately, as China and India become the big powers of the world, we see what's happening to their food choices, and it is just horrific. You know, China has been the place of dark leafy green vegetables. And, you know, I love going into Chinatown in my neighborhood because there are so many dark leafy green vegetables that, you know, I've never seen anywhere else. But the dairy business is growing there, and they're eating more meat, and surprise, surprise, their diabetes rates are increasing at alarming levels, and they are unaware. And they want to be just like us.
Right. Well, isn't that a large topic, and isn't that scary, what you're saying?
Yes.
Everything you said is exactly right. To expound a little bit on that, sure, Japan and China are becoming the largest importers now of our pork, of our pigs. So it's fueling, you know, much of our hay and cow and pork production here in the United States. At the same time, you're right. While they have this incredible innate and cultural awareness and feeling for all the green leafy vegetables and tofu and many other, you know, wonderful food products, at that very same time, they're also some of the largest culprits in the world of devastation through animal raising and slaughtering and eating of animals. That's really true, as well as biodiversity, not only losing land for the raising of these things, but also, as you know, just with exotic animals, and you know, they're the largest importers of rhinoceros horns and tusks, as well as the seven endangered sea turtle species shells. So it's very, very sad what's occurring there. But you're exactly right. As they grow, you know, hopefully they would. You know, they would grow in their awareness levels. There's one other aspect of that will be very large in the future, and we may have to devote another hour or two on this subject, which is aquaculture. China is leading the world right now. Actually, Asia contributes over 93% of all the fish grown in factory fish farms to the world, and over 60%, somewhere around 63-64%, is coming from China, and that's only expected to grow exponentially over the next. Over the next 10 years. So, and that's also an incredible, not only, you know, waste and depletion of life and resources, but it's creating so much pollution as well.
You know, I have to believe at some point, we know it's not sustainable, and if we don't get it beforehand, things are just going to run out, or we're just going to be... The pollution's going to be so bad, there's going to be no fish left in the sea to feed, you know, the small fish and the plankton and everything else that we take out of the fish out of the sea to feed the fish in the aquaculture farms. It's just going to be nothing left. And
no,
we're going to be
right.
So sick.
No, you're right. And there are a couple, I can divide that very profound statement that you just made into a couple different subcategories. And one is that, we are, let's look at it in a general sense first. We are the true stewards of this planet. Instead of just using the word haphazardly, you know, we really need to understand what that means. We've inherited this from, and we're passing it on to future generations. And right, there will be many, many examples of individuals and organizations looking back at what we did to the planet and feeling that, you know, how on earth could we have been so blind and so oblivious? Secondly, is just what you mentioned, dividing out like a subcategory, what you just said, is really about our oceans. And right, and as I said, that's a very, very large topic. I'm writing right now and lecturing about that whole issue, because that is considered the future of our food. It's seafood has been called the health food of our century. The USDA's urged us to eat twice as much fish, and so it is a problem. But it's not just with our oceans; it's also with aquaculture as a whole. It's starting to change. Its appearance. And yes, we're taking out fish out of our oceans to feed those fish. And one large aspect of this whole thing is getting back to the awareness level. We're relying on individuals and organizations for guidance, and yet those individuals and organizations are influenced by economics and by ulterior motives. So whether it's Ted Danson or Oceana or Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch or MSC, they are all providing us with information that's not accurate. So I'm actually spending more time in my lectures now trying to point that out, because that's a huge topic that's not being told by anyone else right now. And as you know, we live, as the statement says, we live because our oceans live.
Have you talked to any of the people from those organizations?
Yeah, they're comfortably unaware. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, I literally now have to modify. I'm increasing most of my lectures and workshops percentage-wise just about this topic, because it's just so distorted. No, it's so convoluted now with what we're hearing and how we're being influenced and versus what's really there. And I can go on and on and on with examples. I can give you just so many examples of various fish species that are, I mean, one large one, just one very small example of all of these, but one large mm-hmm. problem is with lobster. It's considered sustainable. It's considered, it's called a good alternative by all these organizations I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you look at it carefully, both in Canada and U.S. waters and the Gulf of Maine, which is the largest supplier of lobster, we have decreasing number of lobster, we have inefficient trapping mechanisms, and it has a very sad effect on the North Atlantic right whale, which, as you know, there's only 325 of these mm-hmm. magnificent creatures left that we haven't slaughtered, and over 75% of those are becoming entangled and injured in all of those trap lines, and nobody talks about that. You know, we just put a good alternative listed on it, and so that's the type of guidance that just really saddens me, and I feel, you know, compelled to, you know, just keep writing and talking until I fall over.
I frequently say, and denial is not just a river in Egypt. I think humanity has this skill, and it's a skill that now has become actually a liability, where we're able to numb ourselves or tune things out in order to survive. And maybe it helped us thousands of years ago, but now it's killing us. And this way to not see what we need to see, just so that we can go on, because so many smart people do it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. A couple things about what you said there too. You're right. There are. They're not only it's numbing to allow certain individuals and organizations to move forward with their decision making, but also there are these ulterior motives that we're talking about. I mean, you know, there's a great deal of money. I mean, there's $110 billion a year associated with our fishing industry, whether it's wild caught or aquaculture, and they're very, very powerful influences at force here, and so. The other issue is that, right, this really is a frustrating point for all of us, is that, you know, at a point in time when we can just create so many wonderfully masterful ways to, you know, ingenious ways to manage science and computers and technology. At that same time, we are unable as a society, as well as those individuals that are creating all those things, to actually see what we're doing to those rudimentary, fundamental aspects of our life and our planet.
I'm going to take a deep breath now. That was heavy. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
I mean, it has to be.
It's, and this is just truth. You're just speaking the truth. That's all. And we have a lot more truth to talk about. I want to touch on a number of things, treading lightly, some of the people you mentioned in your book, and a little bit about science, but we're going to take a very quick little break, and we're going to be back in a moment. Heartless, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me, and I am speaking with Dr. Richard Openlander, who is the author of a new book called Comfortably Unaware, Global Depletion and Food Responsibility, What You Choose to Eat is Killing Our Planet. I just wanted to touch on the lobster subject. I was, and then it brings in something else that you talk about in the book. There's a number of different people you mention in the book that are really getting the word out about the sustainability issue and how animal agriculture is really causing a lot of environmental devastation. And one of those people is Mark Bittman. He's a New York Times food writer, and I find his writing very curious.
I think curious is a
very diplomatic,
it's a proper term. But it's a kind, you know, kind word for that. I really do.
He had an article recently. I don't know if you saw it, but it was about lobster. Mm-hmm. And so here it is. Some days he gives these really profound discussions about what's going on with animal agriculture and how we need to eat more plant foods and less meat. And, you know, he's right on, and he does it in a great way, and he gives some great recipes. And then he comes along and he talks about lobster, and he said, okay, you know, for all of you, God, I don't know how he put it, but he was talking about, yeah, we have to put it in the boiling water, and for all of you people that are cringing now, the animal rights activists, you know, you can stop reading here. And I know a great story about cooking lobsters. You can read it here. And he kind of, there was like a sickness there almost, where he was acknowledging the terrible pain and how some people couldn't deal with it, but it's too delicious, so he's going to just move on with it. And, oh, that.
Yeah, you better take another deep breath.
But he's really interesting because he's come up with these concepts, vegan before 6 p.m. He talks about the importance, and he's right on so often about factory farms and about pesticides. And then he comes up with these pork recipes.
Okay. Right. Well, let's talk about that, because that's this fourth issue that I've mentioned.
That's the treading lightly concept.
Yeah, and I've added that to your triad now. It's how our information is being disseminated and who's doing it. And right, and I have a chapter in the book that I could have certainly moved out into a whole book by itself. And because the examples are replete with so many people that are doing this. Now, let's just talk about what you just said first. I want to point out, though, how you qualified that by saying that that he's talking about sustainability, and he's talking about, you used the term factory farming in it. Okay, that's where this all breaks down, because the message that we're hearing, and I say this in so many different ways, but essentially, let's do it this way. We have seen tremendous progress lately with all this public awareness of all the ill effects of factory farming, and that's a good start. This is what Mark Bittman's talking about, as well as Michael Pollan and Jamie Oliver and others.
Yep.
But I want to make sure that there's no mistake for anyone in the world to know that for every bit of progress that seems to be, there's this equally strong message that they're bringing along with it. that tells everyone that it's still fine, though,
mm-hmm.
to continue raising, slaughtering, and eating all these billions of animals and fish. Only now, see, instead of with factory farms, Mark Bittman and Jamie Oliver and Michael Pollan are advocating that we can accomplish it by using pastures, small family farms, and our oceans and all the lobster and every other critter that lives in it. And we can use this word sustainable to hide behind and actually misuse. So that's the message that we're all hearing. That's what millions
That's right.
and millions and millions of people are hearing. What they don't hear is what I'm talking about in the book, what you and I are talking about, which is that we're still hurting all the animals, our planet, and ourselves. So in this Tread Lightly chapter, it's stressing that point that we as a society have given through various sources, like various media sources, these people platforms to guide us, essentially, to influence us. Mark Bittman really is probably a very nice person, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, he has portions of his message are fine, but he has this tagging along, this baggage tagging along with it, and it's because you know, maybe he doesn't know about the nociceptors in fish and in lobster in terms of the receptors and the sensitivity that they feel. He doesn't know that. He hasn't become aware himself. And
well, he said in the article he knows the lobster feels pain in the boiling water.
Well, whatever it is, he's giving us the wrong message, and there's something that's lacking in his understanding.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing that's lacking, that's grossly lacking, well beyond all that, is that I have no problem with anybody standing up and saying whatever they feel about anything. But if it's affecting and influencing millions and millions of other individuals or our planet or our resources or animals that need a voice for themselves, they can't speak for themselves, okay, then I don't think that platform should exist for them. And that's an issue, a serious issue that I have. And so rather than saying negative things about people like that, which I try not to do, it is frustrating. You mentioned all these different feelings you had at the beginning, at the onset, you know, frustration
mm-hmm.
and sometimes anger, and
yeah.
which I try to suppress, and disappointment. Well, instead of that, I'm making as large attempt as I can to encourage education and awareness. So he can say whatever he'd like, but, you know, for all the millions of people that he's affecting, there should be all those same millions and millions of people should hear this message that I'm saying. And that's the only problem that I have right now is how, you know, we need to get this message out. And for every person that's hearing the wrong message, there needs to be this stronger and louder voice telling them the truth.
Yeah, well, when you figure out how to do that, because that's been a problem in society, I think, since day one.
It has, but, you know, then again, let's
you know, I want to think that the truth ultimately comes, finds its way.
That's exactly right. It will, and that's I have faith, and that's what propels me every morning when I wake up, when I get out of bed in a sprint to go get things accomplished. You know, that's what drives me. Yeah, because I have faith and I know that it'll happen. You know, another way to look at this is just in the direction we're talking about. Look at Michael Pollan's journey without looking at it too carefully. But he, in 2001 and 2 and 3, when he first started talking about high fructose corn syrup and, you know, subsidies and commercialization of food, I mean, do you really think that he was the first one to say any of that? Of course not.
Of course not. I knew about it for 20 years already.
Of course. How many times have we heard this, okay? Well, look what the effect he's had. I mean, for goodness sakes, he has a movement that's trying to advocate putting him under Obama's, you know, wing for being a Department of Agriculture head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is because he has affected people in a certain way with the way he writes, and maybe a message that he's gotten across, and by the media putting him in the position that he's got. Now, is he telling the right message? No, he's far more exaggerated than even Mark Bittman in terms of making everybody believe that the entire problem that we have in our society is high fructose corn syrup. And it's not. It's a problem, but
mm-hmm.
it's no more a problem, as you know, with any of the percentages, with any of the Western diets, or certainly what it's doing to our environment or to animals. It's nothing. It's a pittance of what you and I are talking about, what effect eating animals has on it. And yet, look at what he's done. He's created this awareness for that, which is wonderful on one hand, and yet he's done what I just mentioned. He's allowed this tagging along of this acceptance that it's perfectly okay to continue doing what we're doing with animals. So, on one hand, that's not so good. On the other hand, I'm using it as an example to say, you know, somewhere along the way, we're going to have the right message and the right timing and the right media exposure to do just what he's done with that, because he hasn't said anything new, really.
Here's a point.
Said it in a different way.
Here's a point that I think is one of the most important things that we need to really be clamoring about, and you do it in your book, and I've done it at home, and it was one of the things I was chuckling on when I was reading, and that is people like Michael Pollan talk about sustainable farming, raising animals, quote, humanely, and that's what we need to do. And if you do the math, we cannot raise the number of animals we're raising today, quote, sustainably, grass-fed, free-range. We can't do it. There's not enough land mass. And
well, yeah. Okay.
I did a very simple calculation. Yours was a little more extensive, but we have to reduce, or certainly eliminate, but we cannot continue doing what we're doing.
Now, there are a couple of different components to what you said. Let's break them down just a little bit, okay? And you're exactly right, first of all, but let's break it out a little bit better, okay? One is that, let's do it this way. I've visited and interviewed numerous grass-fed and pastured livestock operations, both here in the U.S. as well as abroad in the U.K. I've just got back from a trip from the UK where I interviewed what somebody was written about in a book as being a food superhero
mm-hmm.
by having a grass-fed operation. Now, out of all of these that I've interviewed, none of them,
mm-hmm.
not one of them thinks or believes that, well, first of all, let's do it this way. All of them feel that factory farming is a necessity from a land use standpoint, because they know the numbers. None of these places can raise more than one grass-fed cow on anything less than 1 to 5 to 10 to 20 acres.
That's right.
So all of them know that, other than Joel Salatin and Polyphase Farms and Michael Pollan, because, you know, they're I'm serious about that. All of these places would firmly believe that factory farms are a necessity. Now, another thing is that you mentioned Michael Pollan as an individual as a proponent of this. Well, first of all, he eats grass-fed beef.
Right.
He has been quoted as saying, I've got it quoted in one of my slides in my lecture, saying that I eat grass-fed beef. It's fully sustainable. And he said that on Oprah. But it's not. And so the point is that, and here we go back to this, you know, he doesn't know. I mean, he hasn't done the numbers. He hasn't gone out and spoke with these people. He hasn't had to raise one grass-fed cow. I think I put that in my book too. If somebody had to go raise a grass-fed cow, they'd probably understand what we're talking about. The other component of what you said that was very important and shouldn't be either misunderstood or it shouldn't be shoved under the table or the rug, which is the humanity aspect of it. And this should apply, what I'm going to say should apply equally to all animals. And I'm mm-hmm. talking about fish as well. And it's a huge topic because fish certainly feel pain. And nobody gives them any credit for, you know, the trillion or so. It's 1 to 2 trillion fish are slaughtered each year by suffocation and by other means that we don't have to talk about right now, but we could. So anyway, if anybody really followed, that's another thing I've had the privilege of understanding and seeing, not only witnessing, but talking and seeing how a grass-fed animal, regardless of what it is, a pig, cow, turkey, chicken, how it's actually slaughtered. Sure, it has a more humane life during its course of living on this farm, but it has equally devastating, if not more devastating, end to its life. And I have quoted a number of these, in fact I'm writing about it right now in a second book, I've quoted a number of these grass-fed operators in terms of what actually happens in their eyes and what I see and what they see, and it's horrific. And so no, it's not humane at all, and I think people need to understand it from that standpoint as well. I think somewhere along the way I even state, you know, if a child or an adult had to go out and actually, you know, slaughter one of these by themselves, well, that would certainly, you know, not everyone would feel the same way. There'd still be some, as you said, that would mm-hmm. maybe be comfortably, you know, aware of this. but I believe that a tremendous amount of people that are consuming animals wouldn't do so.
I want to believe that. So let's jump over to science, because you brought that up early on, where you were working in labs and discovering things. And I have a science background. I have a master's in chemical engineering. And
that's terrific. That is.
And I've seen, in my time in the technical world, the compromises that are made for stockholders and bottom lines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always want to believe that science is pure, science is truth, science is objective, and we know it isn't. In fact, there are some really interesting studies that are coming out about how some of the most objective studies that are planned still have an element of subjectivity in them, whether the people are aware of them or not.
That's right.
But all of that, there have been a handful of people who have been in the science world. Dr. T. Colin Campbell is one of them who comes to mind, and he's got a really great story to tell. And finally, in his 70s, he's getting the notoriety that he's deserved all his life.
Isn't that fabulous?
But look how long it takes.
Yeah.
He discovered so many things about animal agriculture and realized, you know, he couldn't do what he was supposed to be doing, and he had to take a different path. And how come we don't see more scientists doing that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've hit on another broad subject, and you're doing very well with that today.
Thank you.
I do want to say one quick thing about Dr. Campbell. I mean, he mentioned in I had the privilege of being a keynote speaker just ahead of him on the opening night of the North American Vegetarian Society conferences this year, and one of the things he said, which everybody thought was amusing, but it's just what you just stated there, is that he said he's going to be at it for another 50 years or something.
Right, because he's going to live that
started.
Long.
He said, I've just gotten started at this now. But you're exactly right, and I think this really is a perfect example, though, of how information is suppressed and mismanaged, and many times the end result is really what either gets clouded or different perspective gets placed on it, or the end result is something that is has been paid for or subsidized by those wanting to see a certain end or conclusion. And you know that, and you alluded to that in that question or the comment that you just made. So yeah, and I think that somewhere along the way that the reality of all of this is going to strike, because it's coming in so many different directions now, whereas I think when he first, I know when he first started back in the 50s and 60s, you know, back then to stand up on, you know, in front of, you know, your colleagues or peers and make some statements that, you know, just sort of fly in the face of all of them, and against what they're, you know, what the inherent backbone of not only scientifically, but in terms of their own culture, it just wasn't going to be accepted. So, but all that is going to change as well. I think that it's just moving in the right direction. I really do. Even from the food plate. I mean, I don't, you know, the 2010 food plate and some of the changes that are made. I mean, I don't agree necessarily that certainly could be written better, but we have to look at that.
There's some real interesting things about the food plate. I don't know if you've noticed, and I don't know what it means, but it looks exactly like PCRM's plate that they put out a year before.
It is. That's exactly right.
And, you know, so who's in there at the USDA who has a kind of ulterior motive and did whatever they could? Or maybe they just had no imagination and were just grabbing plate images wherever they could. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, probably a combination of both. and you're right. Now, there are a couple aspects to what we're talking about. One is that, that these things have been suppressed and mismanaged, and that's a large part of this fourth component that I'm telling you about, how we need to, you know, make sure that we have the correct awareness levels raised and education placed in front of us and not being suppressed. But I do think that our own community that are the ones of us that are aware, we're walking kind of a fine line, aren't we, when we're talking about Go Meatless on Mondays and we're talking about taking baby steps. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want to give too much away here, but much of this is in my book, and a great deal of it is how I end my lectures now, which is, actually looking at those two aspects. And, you know, the only thing I can say right now at this point in time without, you know, belaboring that is that if we go meanless on Mondays, which everybody's accepting, even in our own community, that's a wonderful campaign in many ways. But if you do this, you're accepting that we're all babies. We all need to take baby steps, which we're not. And and if you go meanless on Mondays, what everybody's actually doing is that you're contributing to global warming, pollution, global depletion of our planet's resources, and your own health in only 6 days of the week. So instead of seven. And you're creating sort of a false justification.
Absolutely. I have some thoughts on that, and if I was emperor, I know what I would do.
Well, this goes back to our eco tax, though. You know, some of the things that, you know, that I mentioned, sure. I mean, we're doing this. We're complying. You know, we're attempting to do this in a compliance, you know, manner on an individualized basis. But you and I know that and others, you know, that think like we do, that there are going to have to be stronger measures, and that's why I bring up
here's the thing. Some people get it right away. I remember in 1987 when John Robbins' book, Diet for a New America, came out, I was already on the path, and I sent the book to a few people. My brother and sister got it right away and went vegan. Okay, but a lot of people don't get it, and a lot of people need to hear information over and over again about many things, and you've probably seen this, but when I talk to some people, and I really try and use a loving, non-judgmental, compassionate style.
You've got a great voice for that, by the way.
You get this deer in headlights expression, and all of a sudden they reach their capacity and they are overwhelmed. They cannot take in all of this information.
Right.
And so they can't react, and they need to hear it over and over. And so in some ways, that's where a Meatless Mondays or a, you know, 28-day challenge or whatever is helpful, because, you know, it helps move people in a direction, in a way that they can't, that they have the capacity to do.
Oh, yeah, and I want to clarify that, because what you're saying is correct. I didn't mean to say that every single person in the world would move forward correctly by not taking baby steps, by doing exactly what I'm advocating. What I do want to clarify, though, is that we don't have time for baby steps.
Yeah,
I want to make that sure that's really clear. By the time, and you can do all the math that you want on this, and which would be, which I would encourage. But if you extrapolate this out, our scenario of what we're doing right now on a scientific basis, and you brought that term in a while back. You want to sit and look at the global, you know, global network, whether it's our footprint in water or land usage or anything else, we don't have time to be taking baby steps or doing Meatless on Mondays. That's the point that I'm trying to make. And sure, I agree that many people fall into different categories, and there are probably two or three or four different categories that we could discuss. But one of them is that no matter what you do, they're just going to take a longer time, you know, to get around to doing it.
This is the second part of what I wanted to talk about, and the way to speed it up that we're not doing, or we're not doing enough, is people need to get this information repeatedly on a daily basis. It needs to be headlined in newspapers. It needs to be in the pages of magazines. It needs to be on the television and in the movies. And people, you know, a long time ago, JFK had this thing where we were going to go to the moon, and, you know, everybody was focused on it. And during World War II, there were a lot of people in the States that were doing what they felt their part was to support this whole thing. And, you know, we need to come together as a large community and say, yes, we are all in this together, but we need to be bombarded with this information, and we're not. And that's the way to make the masses go.
Right. Now, I think there's still two levels of what you're advocating there. One is what you're saying, that a repetitive, frequent reinforcement of knowledge and awareness by the media and all those sources that we experience each day. That's one level. But you and I both know that there's still a number of people that are going to take longer than what our Earth has the ability to absorb or sustain. So therefore, there has to be somewhere along the way some form of legislation.
Echo tax.
Well, I mean, you know, I'll just mention, you know, we don't have to do it now, but I'll just mention one of these large aspects, which is water usage, which will be our largest resource concern in the next 19 years. and yet you know all the facts and figures. So one of the things that I impress on audiences is that, you know, I end up placing the figure of how much water the EPA feels we're using as a house, an average house in the United States, which is 50,000 gallons per year and 60,000 outdoor use, that's indoor use. And yet, from our choice of foods, if it involves animals, we're using around 315,000 gallons per person per year. And so, times three, in a household of three. So you're looking at a million mm-hmm. gallons of water per household of only three versus 50,000, which is what our government believes we're using.
Right.
So my thought is just this. Whenever there's a water shortage, which there are in the U.S., and it's a regional issue, but, you know, because there's flooding here and droughts there, but as water becomes more scarce, sure, our government should be stepping up and declaring a state of rationing meat and dairy, period. And this is what I mean, and as well as the eco and health risk tax, which would get us on track much quicker than anything else we're doing.
I want to see it happen.
Well,
I really do.
I believe that it will. I just don't know when. And the eco and health risk tax, we far too long externalized, as you know, all of the costs that are incurred by eating animals.
The government has such a great opportunity right now, you know, because
do.
The economy is a mess, and we
do.
Have a great opportunity to rewrite all the subsidies and rewrite all the taxes and right all the wrongs. But I don't think it's going to happen just yet.
Well, it affects all those areas, and it affects the other areas that we're dealing with, too, which is our health care issues, our health care insurance plans, our entire national health care problem. It really would solve a number of issues. So, yeah, I believe it's going to happen, and we can talk. We'll pick a number, and we'll both guess on when it's going to happen sometime. We'll compare notes, okay?
Yeah, okay. We just have a few minutes left, and
sure.
I wanted to talk about what people can do, and certainly they can stop eating animal foods. And you mentioned growing gardens and growing food, and I know that there is some momentum with small farms coming back, even though some small farms continue to go out of business because it's so hard to compete with giant agribusiness.
Mm-hmm.
But we do need to be growing our own food. And kale. I love kale, and I'm glad you mentioned it because
it's
isn't
that great?
It's a super, super food. I did have a question, though. Have you ever grown quinoa? Because I heard some very disturbing information about it, that I guess it grows very nicely in Bolivia, and the people there who were eating it normally, now they don't eat it as much because it's become so popular over here, and now they're going more towards eating some of the easier packaged convenient foods. And
it's sad, yeah.
And that
really
quinoa
sad.
Is relatively difficult to grow.
No, actually, I don't know where you heard that from. It may be more difficult to grow. I mean, what I've looked at, it can be grown. In fact, I was advocating growing more of it in southwest United States, and it can be grown sustainably. In fact, that and a number of other teas can be grown more sustainably than what we're currently growing our current crops on, especially some of our cash crops. So I'm saddened to hear that that's what's happening there. But no, it can be grown, as I said, much easier, much more sustainable.
Well, I believe that it can and it should be, and it's just so frustrating that here we have companies like Monsanto mm-hmm. dumping so many dollars into genetically modified foods that are wrong for so many reasons. And yet, you know, couldn't we just start investigating on how we can
make
quinoa more
point.
Easy to grow?
No, that's actually the point. You hit it right on the nose, is that, you know, we were investing so much money into so many other issues that, you know, we need to start doing it more on our global health issues and how to grow food, and that's exactly right. And there are a number of things, and sure, you could, I guess, on one hand, you could sum up everything into just what you said about simply eating, you know, a purely plant-based diet, but really, there are paths, or one main path that we have to take to get there, and there's a number of little
We have less than a minute now.
Yeah. So we have to work with education. We have to work with our school systems and
Absolutely.
Corporations and communities. That's where I think most of this is going to be coming from, as well as what I said, maybe legislation through some of these taxes I'm talking about.
I really enjoyed talking with you this past hour. It's so nice to listen and talk with a kindred spirit, and I'm sure we could talk for many, many more hours.
Of course.
But I wanted to thank you for this time, and Dr. Richard Openlander, and I want to talk about, or just mention again, Comfortably Aware. Do you have a website?
We do. It's comfortablyunaware.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missaid that.
No,
comfortably
no.
unaware.
Mm-hmm. No worries. It's comfortablyunaware.com, and I want to thank you so very much for you and your program and this opportunity. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay. I hope to meet you soon.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Please go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can get lots of recipes and inspiration to move to a healthier place for yourself, for your family, for the world. Thanks for listening, and have a delicious week.